Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is the second of a two-part conversation originally recorded in 1978 between former professor of economics at UCLA, Armin Alchin, and famous economist Friedrich von Hayek. Continuing from last week's episode, the two talk further about Hayek's economic history and background with unique stories from his past. We hope you enjoy today's episode and stop back next week for a new episode of the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Where did you first read or hear of Adam Smith? Do you recall?
I certainly read Adam Smith first in German. Not very early in my studies. I knew Adam Smith mainly through the history of economics lectures and so on. And it probably was very late that I read right through The Wealth of Nations. At first, the part on public finance didn't interest me at all. I only came to appreciate the semi-political aspects of it very much later. And being brought up on the idea that the theory of value was central to economics, I didn't really fully appreciate him. I think he's the one author where my appreciation has steadily grown and is still growing.
For most, I think that's for most economists. Where did you get your formal education in economics, your first formal?
Well, in Wieser's lectures.
Now, what were they like? Did he just come in and give a lecture or what?
No, they were most impressive. He knew by heart his own book. So much so that we could follow his lecture in the book and notice, I mean, how in this, he spoke an absolutely perfect German with very long periods, so that we amused ourselves making note of all the subsidiary sentences where he would get all the auxiliary verbs in the right. And he did. And he did it equally perfectly when he inserted in his original text. Mm-hmm. Unless we followed it in writing, we would not know how he could remember this very big book, The Theory of Social Economy, in that perfect form, and occasionally pause with a certain trick. He had a golden hunting watch in a leather thing, and if he was in doubt about words, he would pull that out, spring it open, look at it, close it, put it back, and continue his sentence.
I guess we puff on a pipe as an excuse to do something like that. Didn't you mention that Menger's book was more influential? Or am I confused?
A book, yes. A book which convinced me. It was before I went to Wieser's lectures.
Oh, I see.
It's very curious. The man who drew my attention to Menger's book was Ottmar Spann. I don't know what name means anything to you. He was semi-crazy and changed violently from different political persuasions, from socialism to extreme nationalism to Catholicism, always a little a step ahead of current fashions. By the time the Nazis came into power, he was suspect as a Catholic, although 5 years before he was a leading extreme nationalist. But he drew my attention to Menger's book at a very early stage, and Menger's Grundsätze probably more than any other book influenced me.
Yeah. Let me, is von Thunen, would he have been available?
Von Thunen, no, I came to know him very late.
I didn't see him at all. Well, how large was Wieser's class? Was it, say, 20 or 100?
In a formal class to which he lectured, which were notably the kind of lectures, and particularly if the lecturer was His Excellency, the ex-minister, nobody would dare to ask a question or interrupt. We were just sitting, 200 or 300 of us, at the foot of this elevated platform, where this very impressive figure, very handsome man in his late 60s, with a beautiful beard, spoke these absolutely perfect orations. And he had very little personal contact with his students, except when, as I did, one came up afterwards with an intelligent question. It once took an personal interest in that individual. Mm-hmm. So he would have personal contact with 5 or 6 out of the 300 who were sitting in his lectures. In addition, he attended 1 year his seminar. But that, again, was a very formal affair, which somebody produced a long paper, which was then commented upon by Wiesel. But personally, I ultimately became very friendly with him. He asked me many times to his house how far that was due, because he was a contemporary and friend of my grandfather, I don't know. Which, of course, reminds me of the fact that in Vienna, one would have to restrict it. The non-Jewish intelligentsia was a very small circle where everybody knew everybody else. It so happened the other day that somebody was asking me about the famous people from Vienna from the period, beginning with Schrödinger, of course they knew him as a young man, and Frisch, the man on the bees, he was an old friend of my father, and so it went on all through the list, till it came to Freud. No, that was a different circle. I had never met him, and it was a Jewish circle, distinct from the non-Jewish one, and although I moved a good deal later on the margin of the two groups, there was a sort of intermediate group. The purely Jewish circle in which Freud moves was a different world from ours.
Mm-hmm. Were there any Jewish economists in the Jewish group there?
Mises.
I see. Oh, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. And with whom, of course, I was very close indeed. But, it's not correct. Mises was not of the Jewish group. He was Jewish. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he was rather regarded as a monstrosity. A Jew who was neither a capitalist nor a socialist, but an anti-socialist Jew who was not a capitalist was absolutely a monstrosity in Vienna.
See, any place. As a university student, or even shortly thereafter, what were the major topics of interest in economics? Were they technical questions, or were they questions of socialism, or were they questions on inflation, or was there any dominant set of themes that...
To me, you have to distinguish very sharply between two periods, before I went to America and after, when I still retained my connection with the university. And the early period was very short. I did my degree in 3 years. I've mentioned it before, with the law, with the veterans' privileges. So I did, in that period, before I went to America, not take part a great deal in discussion. Well, perhaps in the 2 years, I was already with Mises between 21 and 23. Then the main interests were, on the one hand, pure value theory, and I was working on imputation, and Mises' idea on socialism. As I was starting for America, I had got bored with these two subjects. I still wrote up the article on imputation I had been working on, but I turned in America to monetary theory, largely interested by the great discussions which were then carried on Federal Reserve policy, on the idea they had mastered the trade cycle, in constant contact with Hagot Beckhardt, who was writing his book on the discount policies, Federal Reserve System. It was he who led me in all these discussions on the possibility of controlling the business cycle. And it was in America that my interest in monetary theories that started, for which I had the background of a strong influence of the Böhm-Bawerk tradition. I believe I also mentioned already, I didn't know Böhm-Bawerk as an economist personally, although he, like Wiesel, his exact contemporary, were friends of my grandfather, and I actually saw him in the home of my grandfather before I knew what economics was. But in the Mises seminar, the shade of Böhm-Bawerk was dominating. He was the common base on which we talked and understood each other. And But even in his work, his writings on marginal utility was perhaps more important than his working on interest. I think nearly everybody had some reservations on his interest theory, because everybody accepted his article on marginal utility as the standard exposition really of marginal utility theory. When I came back, I had changed in my interests from value and socialism to problems of capital, interest, money. And I was had, in fact, in the United States, started writing a thesis at New York University under the title, "Is the Stabilization of the Value of Money Compatible with the Functions of Money?" I think you can still find in the files of New York University a registration for a doctor's degree under the subject. But when I came back, I was soon asked to write that missing volume to the great encyclopedia of the social sciences or economics, the Grundriss der Sozialökonomik, which was practically finished there, except that the authors who were to write the volume of money had died one after another before supplying it. So I finally undertook it and didn't do it, because in the end, before I had done it, I went to London and at first had to interrupt working on it. And then before I returned to it, Hitler had come into power and the publisher came to visit me in London to ask me to be released from the contract, because he could no longer publish a work of an author who had moved to England, this German work. Great relief to me, because my interests had moved other tasks. To write while I was starting a professorship in London, a great treatise in German, was clearly impracticable. But it was in the work on that well, I say one intermediate step out of my American thesis had grown a plan for what I believe intended to call investigations into monetary theory, which again only one long article was ever written and published, that called the intertemporal equilibrium of prices and the changes in the value of money, a thing in the Weltwirtschaftliche Archiv, which I believe is probably the most characteristic product of my thinking of that period before I turned definitely to industrial fluctuations and the history of monetary theory, because it was really the history of monetary theory which is all I did for the intended textbook. I never started on the systematic part of it. And that was a stage in which I was invited to give. Oh, there's one other feature I ought to mention. While I was in America, I got interested in the writings of Foster and Catchings. And there was then this competition for the best critique of Foster and Catchings, which I did not take part in. Afterwards, I regretted, because I thought the products were all so poor that I could have done better. And when I had to give my formal lecture on for the acquiring position of Privatdozent, I chose a critique of Foster and Catchings on the title The Paradox of Saving for that lecture, and published it in German. And Lionel Robbins read that particular essay, and that led him to invite me to give the lectures in London. And I drew in the lectures on what I'd done for my textbook on money. And of course, the move to, well, then I was asked by Robbins, I think even before, was it when I was giving the lectures, to do the review of Keynes' treatise. So I had a year or two which I invested in reviewing that thing. But again, I had a curious outcome. The reason why I did not return to the charge when he published the general theory when I published the second part of my essay on Keynes, his response was, well, never mind, I no longer believe that.
The general theory?
It was what Keynes told me about, the second part of my review of his. I think very unjustly, because the second part of the treatise was probably the best thing Keynes ever did.
Two. Yes, yes. You mentioned that Robbins saw your critique of Foster.
Yes.
And called The Paradox of Savings.
Yes.
And that's what caused
him to invite me to give these lectures.
I was going to inquire how come that he had heard about you or knew of you. But in Vienna, you worked with the reparations group?
No, it's not the reparations commission. The peace treaty, I believe the same true of the German peace treaty, made arrangements for the payment of private debts between the two countries which got blocked by the outbreak of war. And incidentally, the claims the Austrians had on the Allies would be credited to a reparation account. But that was only an incidental aspect of it. The main thing was just clearing these debts which had been outstanding for 5 years with extremely complicated provisions because of the currency changes and so on. And I got the job because the condition was to know law, some economics, and several languages. Mm-hmm. Now, by that time, I'd returned from America. I used to speak French fairly well, which I've almost completely forgotten, and I knew even some Italian, which I had picked up in the war. The three foreign languages, plus law, plus economics, qualified me for what was a comparatively very well-paid job, well paid for in the government office, because it was a temporary position. I was not a regular civil servant, but a temporary civil servant with a much higher salary than I would have had. Mm-hmm. So it was quite an attractive position, even if it hadn't been that Mises happened to become my official head.
That's where you met him?
Yes. I believe, again, I told the story already. Yes, I was sent to him by an introduction from Wiese, in which I was described as a promising young economist. And Mises reading this promising young economist, I've never seen you at my lectures.
We are still the same. When you went to work in Vienna, did you carry a briefcase every day with your lunch in it to work and back?
No, I was impressed. We had a sort of canteen in the building, in the ministry opposite. So I lunched there.
Were you married then?
Not initially. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I married while I was in the restaurant.
When did you write that piece on rent control? And what was the motivation?
Well, the cause was simply that I was irritated by the fact that no economist had dealt with it. It seemed to me such a clear demonstration of what price fixing, what effects it had, and that none of the local economists paid any attention to it, or rather, no. There were a few of the social policy people who were all in favor of it, who proved that they didn't understand any economy.
When was this? What year do you recall?
27, I believe. I'm not mistaken.
In Vienna?
In Vienna. It was a paper I read to our economic club. There had been an economic club which died during the inflation period. I don't know why. And I still had been as a guest at the meetings before it had died. And then I more or less revived it, main purpose to bring Mises and Meyer together in the same desk, because they were not in very good relations, really. And that created some difficulty for us younger people. We had to be on good terms with Meyer in order to have any prospect at the university. We were more attracted by Mises, and so we revived this institution, which apart from the Mises seminar was the other occasion for general discussions of economics. And my one paper, the club, was the one on rent restriction, which then was published as a pamphlet in an enlarged form.
Is that still easily available?
Not easily. It's a partial translation is contained in a brochure on rent control or rent restrictions, which the London Institute published, but not a complete one.
Do you have a complete set of your works?
I have one, yes.
Has it? And it has not been published as such or as a collected series, has it?
No, no, they have not been reprinted. But there is, of course, a complete list of my publication in that Machlup volume. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But a list is quite different from the...
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Would you be tolerant of a proposal to have the works all published and made available?
Well, of course, everything in recent years, which is worth republishing, I have collected, but only what appeared in English, not the early things I published in German. There aren't many, and they have some defects that have been carefully looked into. And there are things like that article on the intertemporal system of prices, the one on American monetary policy, the one on imputation. I suppose yes, but both the translating and some revision, for instance, I only discovered years later that in the article on American monetary policy, the printer ultimately mixed up the pages. They don't occur in the proper sequence.
Is it true that Mrs. Hayek has been checking some of the translations?
She did some of the translating, practically. I mean, three of my books were essentially done by her. The Counter-Revolution of Science, one other of the early ones, and finally she practically redid the Constitution of Liberty. There was a complete translation which was unsatisfactory.
Oh, you wrote that initially in German?
Or no, I wrote it in English. And it had been translated by somebody else, and that was very poor, and she redid it.
I see. So we have your monetary theory work in the United States, rent control. Where did the capital theory interest come in? Or can you identify a place where you got involved in capital theory?
Oh, yes, I think it was essentially after prices and production that I couldn't elaborate this without elaborating capital theory. Okay. I was relying on it in its simple Bemba-Werkian form, and very soon became aware that with the average period of production, you didn't get anywhere. And it was planned as a two-volume work, one was static and one dynamic. Mm-hmm. And I took so long on the static part that was finally glad of the excuse of the outbreak of war, that bring out something which wasn't really finished, pretending that I never knew whether it would be published at all if I delayed, and without having even started on what I intended to be the second dynamic volume, well, I never did it.
Now, you're referring to Pure Theory of Capital?
The Pure Theory of Capital is the first part of what was intended to be a two-volume work.
I see, yeah.
The Pure Theory of Capital and the Dynamics of Capital.
Now, again, I've looked at that lately, and my thought was that had Fisher not written his Theory of Interest book with the words, the algebra, and the arithmetic to illustrate it, that your book would probably have been better known and more widely used. Do you have any conjectures to whether that's...
Well, the capital theory is an extraordinary, what should I call it? Forget there is a good English word for it. A thing which refuses simple treatment.
Mm-hmm. Intractable.
Yes. There was another very important book in the Wexelian tradition by a man called Ockerman.
Yes.
Which is really very important, but nobody understands it because it's so complex and difficult. And I think the same is very largely true of my book. It's become too difficult because the subject is too difficult. When Friedrich Lutz, for instance, told me one day, well, after he found the things himself, he finds I've already said them.
Because he had his book on that.
And he never learned it from my book, but he had to work it out himself.
In that Pure Theory of Capital, I was taken by the similarity between your position and that of Joan Robinson and Passanetti and the others at the current English Cambridge School who are objecting to Samuelson's simple model. I shouldn't call it Samuelson, the classical simple homogeneous model. I don't want to associate you with that Cambridge school, but nevertheless, there is a similarity.
I've been told so before, particularly by Lachmann, who carefully followed this discussion. Mm-hmm. I haven't followed it. Mm-hmm.
Well, you might find it entertaining because Joan Robson is saying you cannot use a simple concept of capital and understand capital theory. And there's been a big debate on that. And my own impression is that they are quite right. But when I read your work, or even the work of Fisher, I often wonder why anybody thought that.
Well, I have no doubt you are right because, as I say, Lachmann, who probably knows my work better than almost anybody else, has told me the same thing. But since they came out, I never could return to that interest. And
why not? Or do you know why not?
Well, I've become much too interested in the semi-philosophical policy problems, the interaction between economics and political structure.
Those are more difficult problems.
They are in a way more difficult and, of course, much more difficult to come to clear conclusions. But I've been engaged in them so long. You know, it was the road to serfdom which led me to the Constitution of Liberty. Having done the Constitution of Liberty, I found that I had only restated in modern language what had been the classical liberal view, but discovered there were at least three issues which I hadn't answered systematically. I cannot now enumerate them. They'll come back to me in a moment. So I felt I had to fill the gaps, and I believe that in a way the thing on which I've now been for 17 years, which I've now at last finished, Law, Legislation and Liberty, is probably much more original contribution to the thing. It's not merely a restatement, but I have developed my own views on several issues, on the whole relation between a rule and order, on democracy, and my critique of the social justice concept, which were absolutely essential as complements of the original thing, answering questions which traditional liberalism had not answered. But that was such a big and long, I never imagined in either case. Well, in fact, the Constitution of Liberty I did relatively quickly. I wrote the three parts in three successive years and then took a fourth year to rewrite the whole thing. So I must have done the Constitution of Liberty in 4 years, while, of course, with an interruption for health reasons on Law, Legislation and Liberty. Well, we have 78 now. Yes, since I formed the conception, I didn't immediately start working on it. It's 17 years.
I was going to ask, do you have a work schedule during the day? Do you, in the morning, do work of rewriting?
It has changed in the course of time a great deal. When I most of my life, I could work both all morning and again in the evening. Now, the evening is out now for any original work. I can only read in the evening. And even my steam lasts only for 2 hours in the morning or something like that. Mm-hmm. I usually, if I'm not disturbed, as soon as I've read my newspaper, I sit down to work and work for 2 hours. And sometimes a cup of coffee helps me on a little longer, but not very much longer.
When you're working, are you at a desk writing, or do you pace and think, or
in an easy chair, leaning back and writing on my knees?
I see. Well, that's a nice, comfortable way. You don't go to sleep often, so before you wake up 5 minutes later.
Yeah. Oh, no. Well, if I try to do it in the afternoon, it happens to me.
Very well.
I should say I have my reading periods and my writing periods. When I really want to read extensively, I cannot write at the same time.
You mean during the same week or so, or you mean the same day? Or?
Well, sometimes it's a question of 2 or 3 months that I do only reading. Practically, I'm making notes all the time. Mm-hmm. But I don't attempt to pursue systematically a trend of thought. Mm-hmm. While once I settle down to writing, I consult books, but I no longer read systematically, at least on the subject. Mm-hmm. In the evening, you'll be reading something else, but
in general, for many of your articles, when you've written them, did you foresee when you started what you were going to say, or did you take a topic and then work and work, and pretty soon out came a finished product which was entirely different than what you even thought you were going to be saying?
Mostly the latter. Mm-hmm. There are very few short pieces which I saw clearly beforehand and could write out at once. Mm-hmm. But the normal process is one which I already described, collecting notes on cards, mm-hmm. rearranging them in a systematic order, writing it out in longhand in a systematic order. Mm-hmm. So, only very few exceptional cases, I just sat down and wrote an article.
Let me just make one, just occurs to my mind. If you could have one of your articles or books destroyed because you wish you had never published it, is there any such paper? It was a waste of time and you should have never written it?
I think things which I published prematurely. Mm-hmm. For instance, that article, that early one on the intertemporal system of prices, which I believe contained some important ideas, was clearly prematurely published. I didn't see the things yet in the right thing. It would have been wiser not to publish it at that mm-hmm. time. Although it probably would have meant that I never published these ideas at all. They exist only in an imperfect form. Others. Well, I would have to think of those which I have not republished, which I have probably forgotten. Those which I have
If you remember what they are, we'll know which ones they should have been. Was there pressure, as there is now, so-called publish or perish, in the 20s, that there was a publication matter, getting yourself acquainted with other people, letting them know what you were doing, mode of communication rather than establishing a prestige?
Well, of course, it was, in a sense, very strong in Austria for getting the Privatdozentur. Mm-hmm. We had to publish relatively early a major piece of work. Mm-hmm. It was not a question of number of articles. It had to be one substantial work. But that's the only thing corresponding to the publish or perish which I experienced. But partly, of course, because I was extremely fortunate getting the age of 32 as good a professorship as I ever could hope to get. Yeah. I mean, if you are at 32 professor at the London School of Economics, you don't have any further ambitions.
As Adam Smith said, you're well established. There was an episode in which when I first heard your works, the price production and the, let me call it debate or discussion with Knight over the pure theory of capital. Do you have any memories of that, or stories you might tell us?
No, it was really a very distant affair. I had known Knight slightly. He had been on a visit to Vienna in the 20s, but I didn't know him at all well. And all the discussions in which I got involved, except Keynes, whom I knew fairly well, were really was a distant target of a person who was not a live figure to me. Mm-hmm. He, Pigou, whom also came to know later quite well, was still another one I got engaged in, or one or two Germans, Pali and others. They both were discussions with a distant figure and were not really continued as discussions. I commented upon their work once and left it at that.
They were very hard articles to read. Mm-hmm. The one by Knight, difficult. In fact, Knight's, I guess, attitude that Capital was just a big homogeneous mass.
I never understood really what sense it was a mass at all. I mean, it was not a magnitude in any sense.
In fact, there was a famous the theory of bombing during the war, when there were some of the bombing experts said, let us pick certain topics and destroy specific capital. Mm-hmm. And the Knightians, as they became, said, oh no, all capitalists in time is substitutable. Bomb anything, you're bombing capital. So just go out and dump some bombs on Germany, any old place. That was known as the capital, the Knightian theory of bombs.
You know? Of course, Knight was a very puzzling figure. I mean,
yes,
a man
indeed.
Of such intelligence. Mm-hmm. And capable of going so wrong on particular points. For the moment, you know, a year later, he would see it. But he got committed to a particular thing and pursued it to its bitter end, even when it was wrong.
Well, to someone like me who had known of your works in Price and Production, Pure Theory of Capital, finding the road to serfdom suddenly in the after the war was a jolt, I said to myself, what does he know about? What's he doing writing on a subject like this? But if one knows your history, it's not at all surprising. But at that time, it was a very surprising event to me to see that book come out.
You know, when I started in 39 on these articles on the counter-revolution of science, this was the beginning of a plan of write a major book called The Abuse and Decline of Reason, where what I published is the beginning of the study of the abuse of reason, what I now call the constructivist approach, and the decline of reason was something of which ultimately The Road to Serfdom became a popular advanced sketch. So I had the whole idea in my mind when external circumstances of environment made it necessary for me to explain to my English colleagues that they were wrong in their interpretation of the Hitler movement, particularly Lord Sir William Beveridge, as he was then, who was incredibly naive on all these things, who firmly believed that the bad German capitalists had started a reaction against the promising socialist developments. So I wrote out my basic idea, memorandum to him, and expanded it into an article. And then Gideons here asked me to supply it enlarged into a pamphlet. And then I just had plenty of time during the war. You see, I was in that fortunate position of being already a British subject, so not being molested, but being an ex-enemy, therefore not being drawn into any war job, and having practically no students for the war period, so I had plenty of time. And so after I'd finished the Pure Theory of Capital, I was not having any other plans, so I gradually enlarged this pamphlet into a book in which I was restricted only by the fact that the Russians were then our allies, so I had to tame down what I said about communism, and made it perhaps overemphasized the totalitarian developments of the Nazi kind, and not saying much about it. But it was an outcome of a fairly long period of development of my thinking. But still at that time, I thought it was a pamphlet for the time, for a very specific purpose, persuading my English what you would call liberals, Fabians, that they were wrong, that it caught on in the America. It was a complete surprise to me. I never thought the Americans would be the least interested in that book.
Yet if one looks back at your earlier work on, your earlier thinking on socialism when you were in the Vienna area, and your collective economic planning essays, it isn't surprising if one knows that, but
the planning book had a curious effect on my thinking, because I'm told there's even a paragraph or two in that essay. It was the thinking on the planning problem which drew my interest to the methodological problems, to the whole problem of the philosophical approach to the social sciences. It was quite unexpected. I mean, I first intended to publish merely a collection of translations of the things which had remained unknown in the English literature. Then I was told that I had to write an explanation of the environment in which the discussion had taken place. Then there was some discussion beginning about the problem, so I wrote a concluding essay dealing with the recent literature. But that was all very much unplanned and unintended, although it had its effect on my further thinking doing it.
Did you ever know Thomas Nixon Carver?
I visited him once. On my first visit to America, it was one of the letters of introduction from Schumpeter. And I did, during this 15 months in America, travel as far as Boston to the north, Washington to the south, and Bear Mountain to the west.
That covers it.
And in Harvard, I delivered my letters to Taussig and Carver, and made the acquaintance of both the gentlemen. Carver took me to his country club and gave me the regular luncheon which he always produced. And all I remember that he was frightfully offended that he and John Hobson in England had published books under a similar name, something about distribution, I forget what it was. And my mentioning his book and Hobson's in one sentence greatly offended him.
When I first went to UCLA, he walked into my office and asked if Anderson was present. I said, no, who shall I say came? He said, tell him Carver was here. And I thought, well, there was a famous Carver, but it wouldn't be you. As he left, I thought to myself, he's dead many years ago. But he lived past 90.
And in Santa Barbara or
somewhere. That's in Santa Monica. And he and his wife celebrated their 75th wedding anniversary. Which two things you wrote, I'm thinking my own personal influence on me after your Price production, was the individualism and economic order and the use of knowledge in society, which I would regard as your two best articles. Best in terms of influence I've had
on me. Individualism, the use of knowledge in society, the earlier one, really, economics and knowledge, the 37 one, which is reprinted in their volume, which marks the new look at things way.
It was new for you too then, was it sort of a... it was a new to you too, was it? Was it a change in your own thinking?
Yes, it was really the beginning of my looking at things in a new light. Mm-hmm. And if you ask me, I would say that up till that moment, there was developing conventional ideas. And it was the 37 lectures to the Economic Club in London, my presidential address, which is Economics and Knowledge, which started my own way of thinking. Sometimes in private, I say I've made one invention, one discovery and two inventions in social sciences. The discovery is the approach of the utilization of dispersed knowledge, a short formula which I use for it. And the two inventions I have made are denationalization of money and my system of democracy. I mean,
the first will live. How did you have to get into that topic? When you had to give this lecture, something must have made you start thinking that.
It was several ideas converging on that subject. It was, we just discussed, my essays on socialism, the use in my trade cycle theory of the prices as guides to production, the current discussion of anticipation, particularly in the discussion with the Swedes on that subject, to some extent perhaps Knight's Risk, Uncertainty and Profit, which contains certain suggestions in that direction, all that came together. And it was with the feeling of a sudden illumination, sudden enlightenment, that I wrote that lecture in a certain excitement.
Well,
I was aware that I was putting things which were fairly well known in a new form. Mm-hmm. And perhaps it was the most exciting moment in my career when I saw it.
I'm delighted to hear you say that, because I had that copy typed up to mimeograph to my students, the first course I gave here, and Alan Wallace, who I guess you must know, came through town one day, and I said, Alan, I've got a great article. He said, he looked at it, he started to laugh, he says, I've seen it too, and it's just phenomenal. I'm just delighted to hear you say that it was exciting, because it was to me too. But when did the idea hit you? When you started to write this paper, started thinking about it, there must be some moment in which you could suddenly see you had something here. Was there such a moment that you suddenly said, gee, I've got a good paper going here?
It must have been in the few months preceding that, because I know I was very unhappy about having to give the presidential address to the Economic Club. Mm-hmm. And then I hit on that subject and wrote it out for that purpose. How long exactly before the date it was, I couldn't say now, But I do know that the idea of articulating things which had been vaguely in my mind in this form must have occurred to me when I was thinking of a subject for that lecture as presidential address in the London Economic Club.
Well, that was a very influential article, I must say. Are we fixed on time? Do you have any? About 5 minutes. Thank you. Let's take a well. There's a Ricardo effect in which you've done some work.
Yes.
Do you have any recollections about getting into that? Well, I guess I should go back and say one thing. Go back on this bit about use of knowledge and individually. I would have conjectured your rent control article might have had some carry through on that. That if one perceives that, he can begin to see this issue.
Well, I was recently surprised how much I'd forgotten about that article. I hardly knew any longer that it existed, and it must have played a very important role in my actual thinking. But I find it very difficult to recall now exactly what role it played. It somehow fitted in with my concern with the direction of investment and the role which prices and interest rates played in governing the direction of investment. But I cannot at the moment, maybe the next time when we talk, this come back, it usually happens that my mind happens to in my memory is now a slow process. I usually remember things a little later than I wish I would.
At least you remember them. Some of them don't remember at all. It'd be interesting to get that article and look at it and compare it with the one by Stigler and Friedman.
Yes.
On the same subject and see what similarities there
are. Oh, they are very similar indeed. If I'm not mistaken, they are both reprinted in that pamphlet of the London Institute.
The IEA?
Yes.
Oh, I see. Now, I'll check. I'm a trustee of that board. I should know what they're doing. Let me then return for a couple of minutes to that Ricardo effect, which again came through, I guess, in the capital value theory.
Yes. That was the main result of trying to provide a foundation for prices and production in elaborating the theory of capital, and was certainly in the course of working on the pure theory of capital that I became aware of this fact that the price of labor really very largely determined the form of investment, that the more expensive labor was, the more capital intensive you made production. And then I think it was a pretty sudden event that said, well, this is the same thing which I've been arguing in prices of production in a slightly different form. I mean, the curious thing is that so many people did not see that it was the same argument in a different form.
I think they're discovering it now. Even the reswitching theory that you're coming out, that's coming out of the Cambridge School on the connection between interest rates and the so-called ratio labor to capital is essentially
the same. I've just published an article in the London Times on the effect of trade unions generally. It contains a short paragraph just pointing out that one of the effects of high wages leading to unemployment, and it forces capitalists to use their capital in a form when they will employ little labor. Mm-hmm. I now see from the reaction that it's still a completely new argument to most people.
They're all arguments, even the trade bills doctrine in the bullion currency days is new. In a couple of minutes we have left, you received a gold bar, of which I was happy to be one of the donors in the Montpellier meeting in You still have it?
Oh, sure. I'm going to sit on this.
What was it? How many ounces was it? Do you remember?
No, I don't remember the ounces. I can tell you exactly.
It was a nice big one. I got to touch it and hold it. We were very smart to make that investment for you.
Oh, yes. I have a Kruger Rand. I have a genuine Ducat. I have a genuine Ducat. Ducat. Italian, which was a trade coin for also the last century, and I have a sovereign.
Now, you collect snuff boxes, I believe.
I've been given snuff boxes by various people.
Well, do you have anything that you collect, like money? I really mean coins.
No,
collections.
Nothing. Since my boyhood, I used to be a stamp collector, inevitably, in my Well, really, very early. In a way, I was, of course, brought up as a collector of flowers, insects, minerals, and so on. I mean, in my boyhood, I had a collection of all these. My introduction to biology and the natural science was very largely via collecting.
I see.
And my father had the greatest private herbarium of any botanist in the world at that time, and our apartment was eating up, was being eaten up by places to keep all his flowers, his herbarium, which was finally acquired by the University of Lund.
You had daily duties every day to go in and water and do things that you little disliked.
Oh, it's dry pressed flowers, no watering, no. The only thing was a special box, watertight, in which they were fumigated in order to keep the insects out of the thing. That was a regular process in which I assisted with, what was it, a frightfully stinking substance which they put in.
Not hydrogen, no, that would be not. Yeah. I think our time is about gone, signaling these, but we stopped on a very interesting topic.
My first attempt at scientific writing was, in fact, to identify one species of orchid, which I gave up ultimately because I never could get a live specimen of it. I'm now pretty sure it was merely a variety which somebody had classified as a different species.
How did he keep his herbarium warm during the winter? Was it
Oh, and
just glass cover? It was interior, I think.